1999 Sunstone Symposium presents Session 233, Author Meets the Critics, Religion and Mental Illness, From Mission to Madness, Last Son of the Mormon Prophet, a book by Valeen Tibbetts Avery, with critics William D. Russell and Marvin Hill.
Being asked to chair this meeting, my name is Frances Burtonshaw, and I come from Logan, Utah, and I was the American mother in 1979. I just hardly fit in this group, but I I really enjoy. We've been coming to Sunstone for several years because my husband has given one of his talks almost every year, and his name is Claude Burtonshaw. I'm happy to introduce our speaker today, Valeen Tibbetts Avery. She's a professor. She doesn't look like it because she looks so young, but she is a professor of history at North Arizona State University. And she is the co-author, I'm sure you all know, of Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith. And if you, how many have read that book? So I read it a long time ago, and I've got to read it again because I understood Emma a lot better than I ever had before. And now she's written a new book, From Mission to Madness, Last Son of the Mormon Prophet. And how many have read that book so far?
Well, we better have.
She will be signing this during the noon hour. And I hope that she brought some books with you.
I think they're ordering them.
Because I was in there and I couldn't find any yet.
They're supposed to arrive soon today.
So I hope they're here.
Hopefully time for your signing
party. And the critics today are William D. Russell, the professor of history from Graceland College, and the other one is Marvin Hill, professor emeritus of history at Brigham Young University. That's where I graduated years and years ago. Author of Quest for Refuge, The Mormon Flight from American Pluralism. And when they get finished, they'll just go in that order. And then we'll have questions afterwards. But I'm sure we're going to enjoy this session. Did you want to be first, or did you want her to be first?
Oh, she's supposed to go last so she can correct anything Marvin and I say.
Oh, that's so. The way the critics
Yeah.
go.
Yeah. When Val Avery and Linda Newell visited Graceland in 1976 doing research on their Emma biography, is this coming through all right? Raise it a little bit again. I met them when Paul Edwards and I had lunch with them. I can't speak for Paul, and he's here, he could speak for himself, but for me it was immediate infatuation with these two bright and delightful women in quest of the real Emma. In the 23 years since, Val has hosted me at her home in Flagstaff, introduced me to the Grand Canyon, provided food, drink, and shelter and rest for my weary bones when Albert Peck and Mel Smith and I hiked the Grand Canyon. My wife Lois and I have had the privilege of having Val as a guest in our home in Lamoni, Iowa, and similarly the Russells and the Newells have been in each other's homes in Lamoni and Salt Lake City. That raises a problem when you're reviewing books in Mormon history. We all know each other, and in many cases are very good friends. I call this the problem of incestuous reviews. How can I review the book of a very dear friend in an unbiased manner? Maybe I can't. Maybe I'm too close to the author to be objective. However, I do have two good friends who have graduate degrees in history, have no involvement in either church, have read her book and loved it, and one of them urged me to buy a separate copy for him so I can have Val endorse it for him, assign it for him. So at least I know objective people completely outside the community who loved your book as well. So I'm convinced that my view of her book would be the same or essentially the same if I'd never had the privilege of knowing Valeen Tibbetts Avery. Since Smith was RLDS and became a mixed presidency, I was no doubt asked to serve on this panel in order to have an RLDS representative, since that's where he was at. This book is sensitive for RLDS defenders, since David was in what was called an insane asylum during most of the time he was a member of the First Presidency. As one reader of the Deseret News back then wrote sarcastically with reference to the RLDS Church, quote, "Insanity and confinement in an asylum for an indefinite time does not disqualify a member of the First Presidency from retaining his office." Now, that was a real zinger. This book, like the Emma Smith biography, is sensitive for RLDS because of the issue of polygamy. The RLDS had adamantly denied that Joseph was a polygamist for more than a century. But it is clear from Val's two books that Joseph Smith was a polygamist. While some RLDS have come to accept this as fact, basically those who've studied it mainly, many others still hold to our traditional view that Joseph never practiced polygamy and that this nefarious doctrine was instituted by Brigham Young out here in Utah. My mother, who died earlier this year at the age of 93, knew that Joseph was not a polygamist because her father, my grandfather, heard it directly from Joseph Smith III's lips. My father was not a polygamist. My mother felt so strongly about this that she couldn't understand why I could even be good friends with Val and Linda. I had made the mistake, in fact, of loaning Mother my copy of their Emma book. I had a clean copy I could have loaned her, but I just didn't think, and I loaned her my copy with my marginal notes. Mother disliked my marginal notes even more than the book itself. I hope that gives you some consolation, Val. But the more informed RLDS people have accepted reality. I teach our course in LDS history at Graceland, and when my students read the Emma biography, which I always assign, most of them accept Joseph's polygamy without much stress. I've taught the course for 5 years. My students have always liked, the majority of the students have always liked the Emma book the best. I understand that some LDS historical publications are now leaving out Brigham Young's own polygamy, just as Mormon biographies have tended to leave out his racism and his sexism. I understand that little attention is paid to Brigham's grave here in downtown Salt Lake City, possibly because several of his plural wives are nestled comfortably close to him there. Even Dennis Lithgow's very good article and review of Val's book in the Sunday Deseret News possibly reflects the downplaying of our polygamous past. The article contained only one four-word phrase mentioning polygamy, and the review had just one short paragraph on polygamy, so Dennis was downplaying it too. Yet polygamy obviously was a significant problem for David and possibly drove him crazy, as Val's book possibly suggests. So maybe we can switch positions for the next century and continue the great debates with the LDS denying that Joseph Smith was a polygamist while the RLDS vigorously contend that he was. So I think we could schedule some more debates. Possibly W. Grant McMurray up against Gordon B. Hinckley. Paul Edwards could take on Boyd K. Packer. Maybe Dick Howard could spar with Marv Hill here. And also similarly, the RLDS now baptize polygamists in third world countries, while the LDS refused to do so. Interesting switches in positions over time. I have long been critical of the explanations for polygamy given by the saints. When RLDS historian Dick Howard wrote his Watershed article on the subject in 1983, he saw polygamy as kind of happening in Nauvoo as kind of an accident, sort of snuck up on him or something, I'm not sure. LDS people tend to simply explain it as revelation, at least the ones I've talked to. For example, a physics professor at Graceland, who is the LDS bishop in the ward in our area, told my LDS history class that he can't defend polygamy by rational argument, but instead accepts it, quote, because God said so. God forgot to tell Emma, and he should have known that she would recognize that she would require quite a bit of persuasion, but oversight. My freshman students are much more realistic about polygamy than the historians, it seems to me. They assume Joseph's sex drive had something to do with it. Probably a whole lot to do with it. And yet you don't read this in the history books, at least the LDS and RLDS ones. They see the natural parallels that can be drawn between the relationship of Emma and Joseph and on the one hand and Hillary and Bill on the other. Bill Clinton probably envies Joseph Smith's ability to figure out a theological justification But Bill is merely a president and not a prophet. The point that the RLDS deniers need to realize is the polygamy happened at Nauvoo, and no other person than the prophet could have convinced the saints that it was God's will to defy the moral judgment of Western civilization that had been settled for centuries. Ask John C. Bennett about that. Val has written a very sensitive biography of the Sweet Singer of Israel. I thought the reader could detect a slight pro-Mormon bias in her earlier co-authored Emma biography, because I thought she and Linda were sometimes kinder to Joseph than the evidence suggested. Sometimes I thought quite a bit kinder. But in her David biography, I think the reader will probably not be able to tell whether she is LDS, RLDS, or a Gentile. In Mormon history, I think that ability is a real gift. Val has consulted virtually all the primary sources available, at least that I know of, as well as the most relevant secondary sources. She came to this task well prepared by virtue of her work on Emma. Her research on Emma served as an excellent preparation for a PhD dissertation on David Hiram Smith and in this book. Both books have illuminated the lives of two persons often forgotten, since so much of what has been written is about the men in power, with little attention to the women and the children in their lives. For example, Milton Bachman wrote a major book on Mormonism in Ohio in the 1830s, about Mormonism in the 1830s, and only mentioned Emma Smith three times, and then not particularly favorably. She seems a real non-entity in his book, and on the matter of the hymnal, the brethren have to kind of look over her shoulder and make sure she does it all right. Emma is important in Mormon history in her own right, but largely ignored because she did not go west or affiliate with the LDS Church. David, too, is largely ignored by the LDS, but he's also downplayed by the RLDS because, in effect, we have to sort of admit that God called an insane man to the first presidency. That's not so bad, however, it seems to me. Both churches have had an alleged pedophile in the 12. It is idolatry to make gods out of our church leaders. It's idolatry to suggest they can't be criticized even at Sunstone. Maybe our best protection against idolatry is to have a notoriously sinful or flawed or insane general authority, or pope if you're Roman Catholic. So people will be reminded that they are human if we have flawed people at the top. As one of my faculty colleagues, a conservative high priest, RLDS high priest, told me not too long ago, the LDS men are busy trying to become gods, while the RLDS are busy trying to become human. In his view, we've been all too successful. Val's study of David is important to help us gain some understanding as to why a son of the prophet Joseph, who showed such great potential, went insane instead of realizing that potential. Some RLDS people wondered if David had been poisoned while doing missionary work in Utah. Now, we RLDS find that a very attractive theory, but Joseph Smith III told the saints that not to believe that, and I think his skepticism was well-placed. Joseph III was more inclined to believe David went over the edge due to his experiment with spiritualism in Utah in his association with Amasa Lyman. Some LDS people concluded that David became insane when he came to the realization in Utah that his father had been a polygamist. That was contrary to the position his church had taken, which had hardened under his brother's leadership. It was a subject so sensitive that David could not raise it with his older brother or with his mother. The latter view, which you might call the LDS view, seems most plausible to me. Imagine a person believing his or her religion is the only true church. You know, if you can just imagine that for a minute. Imagine that your father was its founding prophet, and he was adored by the saints. Imagine that your oldest brother is its current prophet. Imagine that your one and only true church began out of opposition to polygamy. That's a central issue of the origin of your church, a social practice which is reviled in the Western world. Now, you're on the winning side here in the battle for a sympathetic hearing from Gentiles that we like to convert. Imagine that your mother and your brother are publicly committed to the proposition that your father, the founding prophet, was not a polygamist. Imagine that you go to Utah and discover that he was, and actually meet some of his wives. Imagine that this is a subject you dare not discuss with your brother or your mother. And imagine that you are discovering the truth Just as you're becoming a member of the First Presidency, called to be a member of the First Presidency of this one true church, which is committed to the historical fiction that your father was a monogamist. Consider that your late father and brother were regarded as prophets, and those prophets believed that you, David, would accomplish great things for the Lord. It seems understandable that a sensitive young lad like David might crack under these circumstances. So this LDS view is the most plausible one to me. Val's treatment of David's marriage to Clara Hartshorne illuminates women's role in a strongly patriarchal society of late 19th century America. The reader's heart will ache for this attractive young woman who begins her adult life with great promise when she marries the son of and brother of prophets. But they never establish a home of their own, and David never establishes himself as a provider for the family. He is frequently away from home on missions. When David begins to exhibit symptoms of insanity, he accuses his poor wife of being unfaithful. Finally, he is institutionalized, where for the last 27 years of his life, he rarely writes to Clara and seems to put her out of his mind for the most part. Nevertheless, Clara, in isolation, remains faithful to David until his death in 1904. Faithfulness sometimes exacts a high price. I ask, would we expect that level of faithfulness of a man then or now? In fact, we might even have questioned, what was the deal about Joseph F. Smith and his wife who went insane? Would a society that valued women expect them to wait 27 years for their man in the institution? Letters from David to Clara have survived, but apparently her letters to him were not considered important enough to save. If she ever visited David at the hospital in Elgin, no record of the visit was kept that Val could find. One other relationship of David bears mention. Charles Jensen was his best friend, and Val devotes a full chapter to their relationship. His letters reveal David is able to be candid with Charlie much more than he can be with his wife or with his brother, Joseph III, or with his mother. Charles appears to be homosexual, and yet David does not reject him as so many men do in such situations then and now. Rather, David counsels Charlie on how to seek a wife, then accepts Charlie's decision that he will never marry. It is to Val's credit that she addresses this relationship in an informed, reasonable, and sensitive manner. Church leaders today, from bishops to presidents, could learn from David's non-judgmental understanding of Charlie's struggle with his sexuality. I suspect if a major church author wrote this book, the relationship with David would not be mentioned. I believe that in Mormonism, we spent much of the 20th century raising the same 19th century questions and giving the same 19th century answers to those questions. I have said before that it is our job to bring the church out of the 19th century and into the 20th century before the advent of the 21st century. Time is short, but Val's treatment of the relationship between David and Charlie suggests that maybe we might have a chance to achieve that goal. Thus, it is no surprise to me that From Mission to Madness has received the Evans Award. It is a touching story of a gifted but tragic figure in Mormon history, told very skillfully by a gifted writer. So in conclusion, I will now suggest to Val her next work, a biography of David Hiram Smith's crazy Uncle William.
I was surprised that Val found out so much information about David Smith. I think that must have been difficult. And I appreciate her research and what she's told us about him. I just wondered whether his life warrants a full-scale biography. Obviously, both churches had high expectations for him. Certainly the LDS Brigham Young thought he might someday be the president of our church. And the RLDS had high expectations for him too and made him one of their general authorities. But in the end, of course, it's a life of perhaps of insignificance because he didn't accomplish very much, not his own fault. I sometimes wondered if maybe a couple of articles might not have served better than a biography. The book is taken up with a lot of detail, which of his missions, but I wonder about consequences, whether he really fulfilled his and others' expectations. There's a lot of emphasis on where he went, but from my standpoint, maybe not enough on what. I wonder, for example, why he was finally convinced that his father was a polygamist. I would have liked to have known what evidence really finally persuaded him, and I'm not sure that spelled out significantly. One of the things that interests me, of course, is that he went insane. And why? And I think Val is right in not trying to decide that, and yet I wish he had spent more time on it. Because he's the prophet's son, you have to ask the question, did it run in the family? Was there any other evidence of this? Perhaps not, but I wish she had spent more time. Perhaps it was his illness. And maybe we can't finally settle the question. Many non-LDS are convinced that Joseph himself was insane. Jan Shipps called him a half-mad prophet. I don't personally think so, but it's intriguing. And she might have spent a little more time telling us about this. Well, I think basically that would be my major criticism. I'd like to have you respond.
Just ready for that?
I would be happy to.
Okay. Yeah, that's how you go up there. And then you might as well sit in this chair in the back. Oops, sorry. Kind of tripper.
Well, Marvin, you disappointed me. You have such a wonderful reputation for being a curmudgeon. I thought he was going to stand up here and tear this book apart from stem to stern. So thank you. I would like to say a couple of things about that, and I'm going to start with your comment first. Does David's life warrant a full-scale biography? And you can imagine the remarks, the facial expressions that I got when I suggested for a PhD dissertation that first at a secular institution like Northern Arizona University, which doesn't really like to admit that there were Mormons in the state of Arizona at all, that I might write a dissertation about the son of a Mormon prophet who became insane by 33. And when I made the argument to get that topic accepted, what I was able to say was that this is not a story about Mormon politics. It's not a story about Mormon conversion. It's not a story about unfolding prophecy. It's a story about a family in the 19th century, the last half of the 19th century, that had in its midst a brilliant and charismatic and forceful, attractive, lovable young man, younger brother of an older brother, fatherless son, who, for no reason anyone could discern, became insane and had to be institutionalized by the time he was 33. And that as much as we know, as we look at what has become a new way of looking at history in the late 20th century, the new history kind of thing, that begins to look at women and the experiences of women and children in the family context, what I saw with David as I became captivated with him and with the way his family reacted was that here we have a story, an account, that we've never had before, of how one deals with this kind of an issue. And so first, There was a period of time between the time that the PhD dissertation came out in 1983 and that the book appeared last year in October. And I worried during that interim time about whether I could ever turn that dissertation into a full biography. And the problem was sources. And so I want to talk about that a little bit as well. Because when a 19th century man who never had his own home, he always lived in a room in the mansion house, had to be committed, his personal effects were just simply dispersed. Nobody kind of knows what happened to the belongings of David, together with his letters from Charlie, correspondence to and from his wife, correspondence to and from friends in Utah. Certainly we know, that he corresponded back and forth to people. But because he was the son of the prophet, people kept his letters to them. But because his life became so chaotic by the time he was 33, nobody kept a nice container of David Smith's stuff. So during the time I was trying to research and to find out about this son, whom I have never heard about. I mean, I always thought I was pretty much interested in Mormon history before I ever got into the formal practice of trying to write a book. But I'd never heard of this kid. I didn't know Emma and Joseph had a son like this. I didn't know and of course Joseph was dead by the time he was born, but I had no idea the family had experienced this kind of an experience. So in the process of researching it, I went through all the archives I could find, all the stuff I could find, all the newspaper things, and there was a blackout in Utah directed toward the sons of Joseph, remember, that their meetings were not advertised except by the Corinne newspaper that rather enjoyed needling Brigham Young. And so finding information was very difficult. So you can imagine what it was like when David's grandson, who was still alive in the late 1970s and early 1980s, he was then in his 80s, would once in a while call me on the phone. And he would say, "Hello, Val, this is Lynn Smith." And I would get my paper out and I'd say, "Oh, Lynn, I am so glad to hear from you. Can you tell me what was happening at such a time?" And so he would read me one sentence. And I would say, "Where does that come from?" And he said, "Oh, that's from David's journal." I said, "I haven't seen that journal." "Oh, yeah," I said, "I know. It's in my possession." "I haven't seen I've seen the one that's out at Woods Cross, Utah. I've seen the one in the RLDS archives. I haven't seen that journal. What comes before that?" "Oh, I can't read that to you. It's too personal." "What comes after that?" "I can't read that to you either. It's too personal." And so then he would read me a letter, from the comments and so forth. And so from 1983, when that PhD dissertation appeared, until 1995, summer school was over. I was working hard, trying 95, I forgot the date, it doesn't matter. 94, 95. I made a phone call to the RLDS archives, to Ron Romigan, to check on a source. And Ron said, "Val, you'll be interested to know that we have just cataloged Lynn Smith's papers. And there's a lot of information there about David." And I said, "Ron, I'm coming." And 2 days later, I was in Independence, and I came home with something like 1,200 photocopied documents. And that fleshed out. I completely rewrote the manuscript at that point. And what that cache of material did was flesh out the family's agony that you see in the book. What are we going to do with David? Is there something mentally wrong with him? What are we going to? How do we deal with him? At what point do we say, as a family, that this brilliant and charismatic younger son of ours has to be institutionalized? And the decision of the family finally to make that commitment came only after David became so ill that he struck his brother Alexander, that Joseph III's pregnant wife was afraid of him. He went down to the railway station and sent off cable after cable after cable and believed he owned the radio, he had built buildings and so forth. And finally, a delegation of the townspeople came to Joseph III and said, "We cannot tolerate David in the building anymore, in the town anymore. We have to do something." Joseph III and Emma, who were still alive, still didn't do anything. They waited. And Joseph III finally did what he should have done 20 years earlier. And that is, he finally went to Utah. It was David's insanity. And Joseph III's quest to finally come to a conclusion about what the nature of that was, that finally got him to leave Illinois. Headquarters were then in Plano, Illinois. And he made his very first trip in 1876 to the West, stopped in Utah, apparently talked to people about his brother's behavior 3 years earlier, in 72 and 73 when he had been here, went on to the California mission of the RLDS Church, came back, and within a week a couple of weeks of his arrival back, put the papers in motion to commit David to the asylum. And so what I'm getting in terms of a reaction to this book that's different from the Emma book is the phone calls coming out of the blue from people who are not historians, from people who are not in the profession, most of them women, who pick up the phone and say, "I simply had to talk to you. My son has just been diagnosed schizophrenic. We have been going through exactly what you have described in this book. It makes it okay." And somehow or other, the fact that the Smith family was not somehow by God exempted from going through this kind of a difficult experience means that people who go through it today don't have to look around and say, what kind of pestilence is the Lord visiting on us? Because we have a member of the family who's mentally ill. And so I don't know whether that warrants a full-scale biography, Marvin. But the one thing I can tell you is that when I got interested in David Smith, I simply couldn't let him go. And maybe it's because I have three sons. They're now 36, 32, and 30, I would be going through what Emma went through with David right now if my boys were having trouble. But I simply couldn't let him go. Okay, the other reason that I found this story absolutely fascinating is that I didn't write a biography of Joseph III. That was kind of an informal agreement at one point between Linda and me. Linda was interested in Joseph III, and I took David and she took Joseph. No problems. But I never really understood the relationship between the RLDS and the LDS churches in the 19th century. And I had no comprehension of the extensive movement that both RLDS and LDS missionaries were a part of in late 19th century American religious revivalism. And during the latter part of the 19th century, thousands of men left their homes, not just Mormon men and not just RLDS men, thousands of men left their homes, Methodists, Congregationalists, and traveled on proselytizing missions throughout, particularly the American Midwest. And the Mormons were only a small part of this group. And one of the things that we've never written adequately is the religious history of westward expansion. And understanding how these itinerant missionaries for all kinds of churches, at first, before the late 1860s, went by wagon and horse team. And then the other thing, now here's the article that I'm going to write one of these days, okay? If I can ever get myself back to the computer after finishing this one. I had no comprehension of how the railroad revolutionized the spread of religion in American society. I had no idea. I consider myself a Western historian. I think I know a little bit about economics. I think I know what the Western, connecting the rails meant in terms of spreading commerce, in terms of settlement, in terms of uniting the nation. I had no idea how the facilitation of the railroad meant. And I went back when I rewrote the manuscript and put a major section in there. Now remember, I'm already under pressure by the University of Illinois Press, who said it's too long. I had to cut 150 pages out of it. And Ron Walker had read the manuscript, bless his heart. He was absolutely wonderful. But he felt that Brigham Young didn't get his due. And so I had to go back and put Brigham Young back in it, stronger than I'd had him in there before. But the one thing that I realized is that the most wonderful proselytizing tool for these itinerant missionaries, Mormons as well as everybody else, were the railroad cars. People got on those railroad cars. They were slow. They were lumbering. They took a long time. They were willing to be entertained by a missionary who was going to stand up and preach the gospel to them. And time again, David did that. And he found, that he found it entertaining. Sometimes he admitted he was an RLDS/Mormon missionary, and sometimes he didn't. But he got into this huge battles with it. And the technique of the confrontation between the missionaries was fascinating to me to understand, too, because it was as carefully crafted as the pugilistic, boxer fights that were going on in all these small American towns. And so you have the two competing representatives of churches who come together in these little hamlets and little small towns. And the word went out that there was going to be an argument, a basic argument in the church, whatever church it was, between the Mormons and the Methodists, or the Mormons and this, or the RLDS and the LDS. People flocked to the churches for these kinds of confrontations. And it was all Bible thumping, scripture quoting, and the winner of the the way it went was that the two opposing sides placed their arguments out there. The congregation either hallelujahed or whatever it was to indicate their support. Each time after they had this confrontation, each side privately declared that they had won the battle.
Yeah, I've read many of these in the Saints Herald, and we won every single one.
Every one, yes. See? In fact, I'm trying to think. Was it Wayne Hammer wrote a really... Wayne Hammer wrote a really nice article about that. Well, anyway, David was wonderful at this kind of confrontation. He was... His personality was extraordinarily effective. And everywhere he went, he was happy to take on anyone. He knew his Bible. He could quote endless passages. He had a speaking voice that was extraordinarily attractive. He could sing whenever things got a little testy. David could stand up, sing a hymn that he made up on the spot. All right, people wrote it down. All right, the RLDS Church still sings David's hymns today, and so he gained the reputation sweet singer of Israel. And I have to admit to you that I thought only the Mormons were doing this. You know, this was only of this 19th century missionary movement that the Mormons were involved in terms of sending missionaries from Utah out, was a part of a larger and far more important movement in terms of our understanding of the basic issues of American religious interest in the American West. The other thing I want to say, and I'm saying this to you, Bill, is that this book is not about polygamy.
So Dennis was right then?
And it is so hard, to keep that. I have come to call polygamy the sword of Damocles hanging over every meeting we ever have. Yeah. But the argument that was presented by the RLDS Church, and they were very effective when they came to Utah, and they were coming to, steal sheep from Brigham, actually. And the argument that they made was compelling. And that was that polygamy was an abomination, that the real leader of the Mormon Church was Joseph Smith, that Brigham Young had led the saints in error, and that the fullness of the gospel as decent people, that is, non-polygamous people, might want to live it, was found in the RLDS Church. For a lot of Mormons, that was a very compelling and a very interesting idea. And in fact, what you have to remember is that the church that David wanted to see established in the American West, and wanted to see his brother and himself and his brother Joseph and his brother Alexander and himself be a part of, is really pretty much the church we have now in the American West. That is, a church composed of people who largely fit in with American life, people who no longer practice polygamy except in, you know, funny little enclaves that hit 60 minutes every once in a while. A church that lost and went away from that extreme difference that the Mormons had taken. And interestingly enough, the gospel David preached and the church that David envisioned when he came west is pretty much the church we have become. I think that's kind of interesting. You may argue with me on that.
What do you think persuaded him that his father was a polygamist?
What persuaded him that his father was a polygamist? Well, there were several things. First of all, Joseph III, his brother, who was the president of the reorganized church, made the statement in 1860 that his leadership of the Restoration would consist of opposing polygamy. But he himself was approached during the course of his presidency by people who had known Joseph, who said, Joseph the prophet. Now I have to be careful, because Joseph III is Joseph the prophet in the RLDS church. Do you realize that? Joseph the martyr, right? Joseph the martyr, people came to him and said, Joseph, your father was a polygamist. You have to understand that. If you keep this track of saying he was not involved in polygamy, you're going to be in trouble. And Joseph III said, no, I'm not. My goal is to clear my father's name. So there were always, from the time those boys were little, there was information circling around Nauvoo. And remember, they stayed in Nauvoo. About Mormon polygamous behavior in Nauvoo, which of course had been the reason why everything went belly up in 1844 and 1845 and 1846. The second thing is that when the Mormons left Nauvoo, they left a city that was in a shambles. We Westerners look back at Nauvoo with the idea that it was this wonderful city. An example of all the goodness and all the virtues of the saints. It was a wreck when the Mormons left. There was no cohesive culture left. There was no law and order. People were taking over houses. It was a city of violence. It was a city where the river rats came in. Counterfeiters were working in Nauvoo. Emma raised those kids in that city, and those boys grew up with people saying, I know what old Joe Smith did, right? We know what your father did. We know all about him, right? So I think that there was a sense, a dualism, in terms of the purity of the church that Joseph III was trying to establish for the RLDS, and the realities of life in Nauvoo, which was a can of worms for the first 15 years after the Mormons left. And the second thing is that ability as a young man to reach people heart to heart. He did it with the remote saints in Iowa and Wisconsin, Michigan, when he was on his Midwest tours. And he did it when he came to Utah. He established firm friendships with people he trusted. The single most difficult one was Amasa Lyman, of course, but Amasa Lyman was so involved in spiritualism, and David saw through Amasa. He was certainly intrigued when and spiritualism was a part of American culture in the latter half of the 19th century. Everybody was involved in knockings, and the dead were coming back, and it was a craze. It was a nationwide craze. The Mormons were just simply a small part of that. So on the one hand, David couldn't resist an invitation from Amasa Lyman, who said, come on over to my house. We'll bring your father and your Uncle Hiram back tonight. Okay? But on the other hand, what David could discern was the sincerity and the good effects and the good intentions of the people with whom he associated. And when Mormons in all sincerity, said to him, David, you really do have to understand. It was your father that asked me to take my second wife. It was your father's wife I married. Would you like to meet her? I think he simply became convinced because of what we would call circumstantial evidence. And he writes this back to a friend. That was a fun thing to do, to discover who Sherman was, okay? The famous letter to Sherman, if I knew my father sinned, if my father sinned, he was, you know, he deserves to be punished. Trust me, Sherman, to tell you the truth, I believe my father sinned, right? That was to a letter to a friend in Hopkins, Michigan, with whom he had established a kind of relationship that he could discuss polygamy with. Couldn't discuss it with members of his family. So I think that he just became convinced. Now I want to talk about his insanity, too. How much time do I have?
Five more minutes. No, we got a lot of time.
I'm going to turn this open to questions to all of us in just a minute. I want to talk a little bit about the decision not to try to psychoanalyze David's mental illness. It was really tough because the whole time I was working on the manuscript, I was quite sure that when I got it finished and I got all the evidence out there and all his behaviors out there described as well as I could, and I had lined it out, that I would be able to give it. In fact, David had a really fine psychiatrist lined up who had no relationship at all to the Mormon Church, who was the wife of a friend of mine in upstate New York. No relationship anywhere with the Mormon Church. He was going to read the manuscript. And then the phone calls started coming in. And I don't know where they came from, but people would get the articles, people read the dissertation. And so there are six theories that have to do with why David became insane or what was the nature of that mental illness. And the first, of course, is that there was obvious hints of bipolar behavior, that is. And I did not know until I got into this, found a remote letter written years later by Joseph III to a friend who had lost a brother to suicide, where Joseph III talked about when David was contemplating self-murder. It was horrible on our family. I didn't know, you know. So that the depression, and of course then you get elation coming on, so you get some signs of bipolar, certainly. There were signs of schizophrenia, of course. And I read the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Volume 4, backward and forward to see if I could figure out what he had, too. Certainly there was the argument that David had untreated hypoglycemia. That was the famous RLDS argument that said if David just has hypoglycemia, then it's a physical cause and we don't have anything wrong with his head. I got a phone call at 10:30 at night one night from a neurologist at the University of New Mexico who said, I had to call you. I just had to call you. The man about whom you have written, David Smith, had a frontal lobe tumor. And there's just simply no question in my mind but that he, you know, his all of his behaviors is a frontal lobe tumor. And I said, but you haven't seen the manuscript. But he said, yes, but I can tell. Okay, so that's number four. Number five is the school of people into which Bill Russell fits, who says that stress drove him crazy. That the stress of poverty, the stress of dealing with polygamy, the stress of dealing with family issues, spiritualism, and so forth, and I outlined them. I think I had eight different areas of serious issue that he was dealing with in 1872, 1873, and certainly his life was not easy, and it was stressful. But stress itself does not drive us most of the time into institutions. And then, of course, there were people who felt that by becoming involved in spiritualism, that probably drove him over the edge. And I decided that if I dealt with that issue of his mental unbalance fully, it would take at least a chapter away from his story. And that when we think about dealing with mental illness, common perception about from people who don't have a family member struggling with this disease is that you take, for the most part, you can take your medications and it's going to be okay. I have a daughter-in-law who spent her whole first part of her career working with the La Frontera program in Tucson and also working here in Utah with the mentally ill, people who had difficult problems. I worked extensively with these kinds of people. She said, you know, alleviate those symptoms with these kind of medications enormously. David's family didn't have that, Circe's. Joseph and Emma, Joseph III and Emma, didn't have the ability to simply give David a pill and have him be okay. And I finally decided I wasn't going to diagnose his disease. I don't know what it was. The death certificate said that he died of that he suffered from dementia melancholia coupled with diabetes. And diabetes, I think, was probably adult onset diabetes. He gained a lot of weight when he was in the institution. So the story is about mental illness, but the story is not about the diagnosis of what mental illness he had. It really doesn't matter. What's important to us is how he dealt with it. And I don't know if I've answered your question about what about the insanity. But I want to stop now. And if my two critics would like to...
How did Emma respond when he came back and told her that you... Here's a polygamist.
Marvin has...
We went into the tape, so don't you say it into the lamp.
Marvin has asked me, can you... Do the question again, Mark.
How did Emma respond when he came back and told her that he thought his father was a polygamist?
I don't have a very complete description of that event. The only thing I know is what I put in the book, and I can't remember where it is, where he came to the door after one of those trips to Utah and said, Mother, why have you deceived us? No one left a record of her reaction to that statement. And so I don't know what her reaction was. It was apparently enough of a stone wall that he could not easily discuss it with her. And remember, Emma had just gone through also a very difficult time where Louis Biedemann, her second husband, had filed with another woman in Nauvoo. And 4 years later, when that child was only four, the mother was unable to take care of it, and Emma took in young Charlie Biedemann and raised him. And so Emma's relationship with men as husbands and their relationship with women other than herself as wife was not a very happy one. And I just don't think she wanted to talk about it. I don't think Emma was any more inclined to talk about Joseph's polygamy with her children than most people are inclined to talk about their sexual affairs with their children. And she just simply didn't do it. Yes, go.
Yeah, you said that the book wasn't about polygamy, and also indicated that you thought David was preaching pretty much the gospel that emerged in the West. But anyway, to the extent the book is about RLDS-LDS relationships, then for RLDS, polygamy really is the issue because that's the core issue separating the churches. Traditionally, we've said that polygamy and succession, lineal succession in the presidency are the two big issues between the two churches in the early days. But I think clearly polygamy is the core issue. Polygamy is the core issue, and since Emma rejected polygamy, didn't go west and so forth, and her sons followed in her beliefs and so forth, then the RLDS church fixed on lineal succession in the presidency as the proper way to proceed. But I think polygamy is the core issue. And so I think from an RLDS perspective, it's a very significant part of the book. And when you consider then that apparently polygamy was... Joseph III so hardening his position on polygamy that nobody else could talk openly about it, including his younger brother, who's his counselor in the first presidency at the end of his sane days, more or less, then I think it's key. If David H. Smith had remained a sane person, he appears to be the most attractive, successful missionary, popular missionary and so forth, could have had a great effect, positive effect on the RLDS church. And so the tragic story of this guy going down the tubes, I think, is very important. Also, I think another important bit on the question of whether or not the book is important, it seems to me that in both branches of Mormonism that we have here today, we have a very strong tendency to create extreme pressures on those who are descended from big families. I mean, in Utah, it's mainly the big families. In the RLDS Church, those who descend from Joseph Smith Jr. and the men in the direct descent then having the opportunity for the presidency of the church, I believe most of those men resisted that, feared that possibility for a long time. I know W. Wallace Smith, who became president in 1958, for a long time was a cigar-smoking hardware salesman in St. Joseph, Missouri, resisting, you know, that call. But finally, the call was overwhelming, I guess. Paul Edwards recalls his son, that is Wallace's son, Wallace B., in college, telling Paul, "I don't want anything to do with this." And he became president of the church. Then on the other hand, you have those like Paul Edwards himself and Melvin Smith here, who's, of course, in the LDS tradition, but nevertheless Paul and Melvin reflect people who are direct descendants of the Smith family, but they're not in line to become president. You know, Paul is his mother was the eldest child of Fred
Actually,
M. Smith.
She should have been the president.
She should have been the president. As she said in one of her letters, "If I had a penis, I'd be prophet." But but she didn't, and she wasn't. And Paul's descendant from her, so Paul couldn't be president of the church either. But yet, you know, his father is a member of the first presidency. His grandfather was president. His presidential address in the Mormon History Association, I think, you know, reflects a lot of his reflecting on that dilemma. And Mel, of course, is a descendant of Samuel Smith. You know, and so anyway, I think at both churches we put horrible burdens on people who have this, like David H. Smith, you know, who was, even before he's born, you know, these great promises are being made about what's going to happen. But I think a biography of David Hiram Smith is very informative about a great deal that goes on in both of our churches.
Thank you, Bill, but I do have to say something, and that is that, you know, we women find this argument about male descendants to be a little bit on the sideline. So, yeah, thank you very much. I want to turn this, yes. To compare, he's asking if I would compare Joseph Smith, the prophet, the martyr, with David, his son, right? I think so. And it's interesting because, remember, David never knew his father. Emma was 5 months pregnant with David in June of 1844 when Joseph was killed. So anything that David knew about his own father had come to him either through the boys talking in Nauvoo, through old RLDSs and LDSs, all right, coming together after the reorganization was established in 1860, old Mormons in Utah who could take him aside and say, "I knew your father, and this is what he was like, and this is what he did." But what I saw in working with David was that he somehow inherited his father's charismatic personality. Certainly Joseph II could influence people and had an affable way of dealing with them and was a natural leader. People followed him. David was exactly that same way. And every time he went to a little remote congregation, people would write back and forth and say, "David has left us. We are so bereft. You know, we don't know what we're going to do without him." So I think that there were some family characteristics there in terms of personality and the ability to engage other people that David probably inherited from his father.
And Joseph Smith III strikes me as a legalist. You know, he was trained for the law, and his answers to many questions are very legalistic. So I can't imagine that he had the personal attractiveness that David did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it could have been an issue with the brothers, mm-hmm. because Joseph III was more powerful, but David was more popular. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Let's talk about Brigham Young for just a moment here. Was there a scenario that Brigham Young had in his mind of how David should become president of the Mormon Church out west? What was Brigham Young's thinking?
Brigham Young, can you hear the question?
The mic can't throw it.
Brigham had a problem. And it was that he really believed quite strongly in lineal descent. And he really thought that Joseph III should, at some point, become president of the, capital T, church, capital C. But Brigham's definition of the church, of course, was that it was the church in Utah. And Brigham just, he had a terrible time dealing with the issue that Joseph III willingly became president of the wrong church. And so when it became obvious that Joseph III, with his legalistic mind, his organizational abilities, was going to stay in that church, then he went to the phrase he used, the son of promise. And there are several places in the book where I deal with the expectations that even David didn't understand he was walking right into when he came to Utah. And that was expectations that had been raised by Brigham's sermons and Brigham's statements to various people at different times, that since Joseph III had given up his birthright by becoming president of the wrong church, David, the son of promise, conceived before the prophet died, would then be the one. So David arrives, I think, pretty much not understanding that there might be a group of people who were waiting. And the other thing is that I can't document this, but I'll bet David didn't take a walk or breathe a breath that Brigham Young didn't know about it the whole time he was in Utah. Because I can't imagine that he was not watched. Yes, Paul.
What's the Biden influence
on? Ah, yes, the Biden. You know, I'm going to say a heretical thing in this room, and you can write it down. And that is, I like Louis Biteman.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, I liked the man. And he was kind of an odd duck. He told some corny jokes.
He was no more Joseph.
Pardon?
He was no more odd.
Oh, no, he was no more odd. No, he was no more odd than Joseph. And he stepped in a second marriage, married the widow of a man that everybody, you know, had strong feelings about. I am sure he must have been frustrated out of his tree at the endless times Alex and his large brood of children, Joseph III and his brood of children, David and his wife and baby, Julia and her drunken husband, mm-hmm. all occupied rooms in the mansion house, which Louis Biteman was paying for and keeping up, right? And he saw to it. It was Louis and Emma together, whose home in Nauvoo was the place where all the young people could come for parties of all the church, of all the religions. So Biteman had to be an affable host to young people. I think that the real difficulty between Biteman and Joseph III probably came with the birth of Charles Edwin Biteman, the illegitimate son. And there was, you know, as adults, the boys were a little edgy with some of these kinds of things. But David liked Louis Biteman. He had a good sense of humor. So David learned his sense of humor from that. And you get the letters where David writes to him where he's away, and he says, you know, the weeds are growing up, and there's some battle with Mrs. Hodges, but, you know, don't worry about it. It's not going to be a big deal. And he addresses his stepfather in an affectionate manner. And so I think he, too, had a good influence on Emma and those kids. And it was a stable. I see Emma and Lewis's marriage, their ability to keep that boarding house going, and to raise these five children. I left out Frederick here, who died in Nauvoo before he was much older than 23, 24. Five children of the Smiths, Louis Biteman raised, and every one of them turned out to be model citizens, good people, responsible people, people whom the conclusion that I came to in writing the book was that the biggest tragedy for the LDS people is that they lost the sons of Joseph, who had been raised by Louis Biteman to be good kids.
Yes, the best marriage she had, wasn't it?
Pardon?
He was the best marriage Emma had.
I would say yes, that she was happier with Louis than she was with
Joseph. In a longer marriage.
Yeah. was not always easy. It wasn't always easy. But, you know, the Mormon I was the maddest, the most angry with in the book. I'm going to get to your question in a minute. The Mormon I was the most angry with in the book, and I can't remember who it was. I have to go back and look again. Was the one who came through. He himself was a polygamist, had several polygamist wives. He was on his way to do a mission, and the Mormons always stopped off in Nauvoo to check on Emma to see what was going on. So he described Emma's house. Old Lewis Biteman spitting on the stove, all right? Probably chewed tobacco. Emma looking worn and old. She was probably 45. She was old. She would be old. 55, probably about 55. And then the horror with which he described this illegitimate child walked through the kitchen and called Emma Ma, right? And he couldn't see the compassion that Emma felt in terms of taking this illegitimate child of her husband's to raise because his own mother couldn't. And I thought,
yeah.
Okay, question.
First of all, I love your book. Thanks for writing it. I wish that the other 150 pages in.
Thank you.
Two-part question. I got the impression from the book that Joseph Smith III probably was convinced that his dad was a polygamist, but that out of respect to his mother and church, he couldn't admit that publicly or even maybe to himself. I wondered if that was true. Also, I wondered if the RLDS church today tends to
those are excellent questions, and we have Paul Edwards and Bill Russell here both, and I would like to turn that to you. Do you think Joseph III thought his father was a polygamist? Paul first and then Bill.
Yes.
In a nutshell.
No.
The other nut.
Well, I think
isn't history wonderful?
Well, I think Paul might be right, but I think he had such a strong need to ignore the evidence that it may well be that he really convinced himself, like a lot of people do, convince themselves contrary to evidence that all the rest of us see. So I think that's a possibility. As far as the RLDS today, Paul might want to rebut me, but as far as the RLDS today, Dick Howard wrote this article in John Whitmer Journal in 1983. It really started the Mormon History Association, as I understand it, and I think Paul can correct me if I'm wrong. Kirtland, JWHA 77, I think it was. Larry Foster had a paper on polygamy. I chaired that session, as I recall. Apostle Bill Higdon was in the audience. And Bill goes back to Independence and tells Wally B. Smith, who's maybe it was 78 kind of thing. Anyway, Wally was president-elect, or emeritus during that year. And Bill goes back and tells Wally B., you know, we really probably ought to take a hard look at this polygamy thing. Possibly we've not been explaining that right over the years. And so Wally B. asked Dick Howard, the church historian, to study the matter. Dick does a paper. He presents it to the History Commission in Lamoni, which Paul and I were on. And the paper, you know, admits that Joseph was a polygamist. And then he presents it to W. Wallace B. Smith. And now, what to do with it? And the general authorities look at the paper, and some want to bury it, like general authorities sometimes want to do. But I guess some of the general authorities, including Wallace B., said, "No, let's publish it." But where to publish it? How about the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal? And so we in the JWHA agreed to publish it in the journal in 1983 issue. But by then, Paul could correct me if I'm wrong, I think Dick had toned it down a decent amount when it finally came out in the journal. So people who read it aren't really sure whether Dick Howard is saying that Joseph was a polygamist, and it's just this kind of it kind of happened in Nauvoo, but Joseph might have had something to do with it. I mean, but nevertheless, it's an important shift in our thinking, because now the official church historian has put, well, you know, kind of looks like he was a polygamist. And I think, you know, since 83, more and more RLDS people have accepted it. Certainly my students don't have any trouble accepting it. I mean, well, some resist it if they've been brainwashed by their parents or my mother, you know. But for the most part, my students can accept it fairly well.
Paul,
but I'd still probably majority don't today. I suspect still a majority don't believe it.
Well, I think Bill's right. I think the transition occurred around
yeah.
must be somebody else. I don't want to run into it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It just doesn't seem to be an issue anymore.
Maybe it is. Au contraire, my students, even though they accept it, they fight it for the first month or so of the course. And when they read Val and Linda's book on Emma, you know, and I have them ask questions. I have every student submit a question card every single day, and the questions are just filled with polygamy questions. Now, but they do ultimately accept it. But they certainly, it's a big issue for them.
Pretty good sign of what people think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I came to the private conclusion, but I didn't put it in the book. That by the end of his life, I think Joseph III did believe that his father had been involved in polygamy, but that his statement, "I am here to clear my father's name," and indicates that he felt that he could redeem. His job was to redeem his father. And the other thing that gave me a clue to that was remember his relationship with what you call Crazy Uncle William.
Mm-hmm. Paul's uncle.
Joseph the martyr's brother William, when Joseph III said, "I need an affidavit from you, William. You were alive with my dad. You were in Nauvoo during all of this was going on, and you will fail to remember that polygamy occurred in the Smith household." There's a wonderful statement where Joseph III writes him that letter, and William complied. William, who himself had two wives or three wives, failed to remember that. So, Kurt, next.
Sometimes we forget things.
Yeah.
Bishop.
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing that I do have to remind you is that Linda and I were banned by the LDS Church for establishing polygamy in Joseph Smith's home, not by the RLDS Church. Whatever. Okay. Boy, there's a nice PhD dissertation. The question is, from my perspective, can I give?
We'll pass it off to Todd.
Yes, we'll pass it off to Todd here, who's Todd Compton, standing over in the corner, author of In Sacred Loneliness, The 33 Wives of Joseph Smith, that he's just read about. The question was, can I talk about the lack of Joseph Smith's children, given what we know about that? I am convinced that there were children that Joseph fathered in Nauvoo that were hidden by the families to which they were born because situations were so tense. This is not my dissertation. It's not my proof. We have the children named Josephine, the deathbed confessions of mothers, and Joseph's legendary fertility, shall we say, right? And when Linda and I were working on the Emma Smith, there was always this collection that we were not allowed to see that did some of the genealogical work in terms of the births of children showing up in homes in which they could not have happened. So I really don't know about that. I kind of suspect that certainly some of those wives must have in some manner become pregnant. And then, of course, that raises the ugly issue of John C. Bennett and abortion and those charges of his services being available to anyone who needed them in Nauvoo. It's a can of worms. Yes?
Is there any evidence that Joseph Smith supported those women, those wives of his, materially?
Yeah, the question is whether Joseph supported the plural wives of his. Actually, there's very little evidence of that. He didn't do a lot of money making work. And Marvin, you might want to talk about that a little bit more. I kind of suspect that you know a lot more about Joseph Smith than I do.
I don't know. I never heard that he supported any of
them. But I don't. It wasn't a situation where he. First of all, he didn't have enough money to support his own family. Emma was mostly doing that with income from boarding house. And Joseph was speculating a little bit in land, but I don't think he made any money off of it. And so I don't have any evidence that money, in terms of support, went from Joseph to any of the women that he married as plural wives. Okay, now there's a question here and then here.
There's evidence that Joseph's plural wives actually lived in his own home?
Yes. Yes. In that way, they would have been supported. The Partridge sisters, the Lawrence sisters, and so forth. That's right. Lived in his home.
Was there a problem that my dad with the doctrines of the Utah Church and his own church, such as Brigham Young's Adam God doctrine, and also the building of temples that Joseph Smith and his father emphasized while he lived, and the work for the dead?
David didn't leave in his letters. He may have questioned some of that. The only thing I have are his sermons. Some of them were published in the Herald over the years. And mostly he preached a gospel, and particularly you have to look at his lifespan, because by the time he made his very first trip to Utah, he was engaged or thinking of marrying Clara. So the idea of plural marriage was on his mind. And he came back and wrote a tract that was very strongly anti-polygamy in his statement. So that I don't find him dealing with those kinds of differing theological issues between the churches. He mostly saw it in a black and white, mm-hmm. polygamy or not polygamy issue. The temple had been a very difficult issue in Nauvoo before the Mormons left, after the Mormons left, then when it burnt down. Then the new building of the temple in the Utah, because it symbolized to most of the RLDS polygamous relationships.
That's why I think I would assume that David Hiram Smith, since he's silent on those issues of plurality of gods and temple rituals, baptism of the dead, and so forth, and as well as the church-state relationship, that's the different kinds of attitude toward church-state relationships, I would assume he was with his older brother on those issues if he's mm-hmm. silent on the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's why I tend to disagree with your statement that he was kind of preaching the gospel that appeared in the West. I think the RLDS Church is a rejection of everything that happened in Nauvoo, period. I mean, every new innovation that occurred in Nauvoo, we ultimately rejected. And so, as some have said, the LDS Church was a natural extension of Nauvoo, and the RLDS said, no, we're going back to Kirtland, forget all the stuff that happened in Nauvoo. And so I suspect David's more like, it was really more RLDS than LDS in his doctrinal teaching.
There was a hand over here. Very briefly, it was informal. We did not receive any written notice. I read about it in the Los Angeles Times.
Question.
I'm sorry. The question was, what was the nature of the ban against Linda and me? And it was essentially, apparently, phone calls that had went out to various regional representatives saying that Linda and I were not to talk about history in any church venue.
Why?
Because we had been too liberal with Mormon Enigma. And so... Yeah, I still do not fully understand that. Well, whatever that was. There's a question here.
Was there ever a psychiatric diagnosis? You kind of referred to it from the mental hospital. Was there a medical diagnosis?
Good question. Was there a medical diagnosis from the medical hospital? Yes. But it wasn't very scientific in terms of what we are accustomed to. Let me talk about that for just a minute. David was just remarkably lucky because he landed into one of the most advanced insane asylums, and that's simply what it was called. So I'm going to refer it to it as that. One of the most advanced insane asylums in the nation. Edwin R. Kilbourne, who was the first director of the Northern Illinois Asylum for the Insane, was a man who came out of hospital administration practices with a whole new idea, which had been fostered by Dorothea Dix's campaign against the treatment of the mentally ill. And the problem with those institutions is that at first people defined criminal behavior as a mentally ill behavior. And so for many, many years, people who were genuinely mentally ill were placed in the same institution, and of course the shock waves, the confinements, the being locked in the cribs, and so forth, were still in some ways a part of this institution. But Edwin Kilbourne ran a humane and decent insane asylum. And when David landed there, it was one of the luckiest events of his life. Now, when he came, the way that there was a hearing, and the sheriff had to arrest David and take him to the asylum. And in the hearing, David's behavior had to be described. And so in the trial in which David was committed to the asylum, his behavior was outlined that he was delusional. His delusions were described. His threats of violence. Various people testified, although that whole testimony was not taken down. And in the end, he was certified to be unable to live among normal people. When the family agreed that he would go into the asylum, they didn't put him in as a custodial case. They were absolutely convinced that David would be cured in the asylum. And the common belief about mental illness was that mental illness was caused by the chaos of 19th century American culture. We might relate to that at the end of the 20th, right? And so those asylums were designed in a wonderful way where every window was level with the next window. Symmetrical lines, carefully organized routines of the day. Every single morning breakfast was at the same time. Every single day the bells went off at such and such a time. Every single bed coverlet was exactly the same inches from the floor. So that the order imposed by the institution on the disordered mind was believed to cure it. Well, it didn't work. But it certainly was, an attempt to do that. So that he was judged to be mentally unsound. And then, like I said, the death certificate listed dementia melancholia as his reason. But schizophrenia as an aspect of mental illness had not even been isolated yet, discovered, however you want to say that. All right.
Most schizophrenic behaviors appear in the later teens, early adulthood. Did he, in your research,
He did.
Do you think he really was mentally ill? He wasn't just shoved in institutions?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. There is absolutely no question in my mind that David was mentally ill, seriously mentally ill.
Joseph Smith wasn't just putting him away because he'd become a
had because come to he recognize believed that in the right church.
Was to save embarrassment to the church.
And that was, yes.
He said he attempted suicide.
Yes. And I don't know anything about it except that in later years, Joseph III, who was a compassionate man and terribly concerned about the welfare of his people, wrote a letter to a fellow RLDS member and said, I know about the death of your brother, the suicide of your brother. There was nothing you could do. You mustn't blame yourself. When my brother David was determined he was going to do self-murder, we learned that there was not anything we could do about it. He was trying to alleviate the guilt that the family, this other family. And I read that letter written much later and thought, wow, I didn't know that, So in terms of dealing with delusions and in terms of dealing with person mood and personality disorders, they were also dealing with David, who he also believed that Joseph finally came to the belief that his brother Joseph, whom he loved dearly, Joseph III really became David's father figure in many ways, his religious father figure. Louis Biedemann was not a religious man, but he tolerated the boy's interest in religion. But finally, David became convinced and wrote in his journal that Joseph was trying to kill him. So, yeah.
Didn't Biedemann say, I believe in one God who has neither clerks nor, I can't remember the rest of the quote.
Yeah. George. Oh.
The last 150 pages.
When you cut a book There are two or three ways to do it. One is to take out huge sections, and one is to just make every single thing you say very concise. And I went through and took out as much. If I had to cut it, I figured out how much I had to do it. And so basically there's not a huge section cut. But what I could not do was add further chapters. I couldn't to add a, it would have taken a good 45-page chapter on the probable speculative nature of what David's illness would be called today. And I couldn't add that one in. And I had to add more information about Brigham Young. So basically what I took out was wordiness. I made it tighter. Yeah, there aren't any really big secrets that I took out.
Darn. We've got about two more minutes, I think.
Wait, yes, I'm looking at my clock too. Is there one last question?
2 minutes?
Yes. I'm just curious what happened to his son. Oh, what happened to his son and his wife. David was committed in 1877. Clara, as a dutiful daughter, went home with her parents, who decided then to go to a remote corner of Iowa, which had not yet been settled, and to farm there. And since she was an unmarried daughter with a small son, it was her job to be really the servant in the house. And she just lived a life of physical, hard labor. Milking and cleaning and taking care of her mother finally died. Then her father became an invalid for a long time. Young Albert, David's son, whom he named Albert Aoriel, much to Albert's dismay as he grew older, he kept trying to keep that name hidden because it was too romantic, grew up on the prairies and became the kind of kid that I think his father always dreamed of having. When he named him Albert Aoriel, he had to write to Joseph III and apologize for not naming him Joseph. Hmm. I mean, in the Smith family, Joseph is...